wondering, how can we take these teachings home with us and practice them in our daily life? And of course, the main thing is to give your meditation priority. There was a teacher came into his class with an empty glass, actually a big glass, and he took some stones out of his bag, and one by one he put the stones into, more like a jar, into the jar until he could get no more stones in. And he asked his class, is the jar full? And the class said, yes. He smiled, and from his bag he got a bag of gravel, small stones, and he put those small stones in the jar, shook it, so those small stones could find a place amongst those large stones. And then, is it full? He asked the class. And the class were onto him now and said, no, you can probably find some way to fit something more in. So he got out some dry sand and he poured the sand on the top of the jar, shook it, and much of the sand found its way in the spaces between the big stones and the gravel. Is it full? Said the professor one more time. And the class said, no. So he got the water jar and poured the water in until that sort of water went in the spaces between the sand, the gravel, and the big stones. And once he'd filled that jar up, he said, now what does this little demonstration show you? Now this was a class in modern times. So one of the students put his hand up. It proves to us, sir, that no matter how busy we are, we can always fit something more in. No, said the professor. It proves that if you want to get the big rocks in, you have to put them in first. The precious stones of life. So if you want to do any meditation, you have to schedule it in first. Not fit it in amongst all the other duties you have. If you want to spend quality time with your family and loved ones, schedule it in first. Or at least second after you've finished. Otherwise, you'll never get around to it. The other things you can fit in, but the big stones, the precious rocks, you have to put them in first. So a lot of times it's all about priorities. What really is important to you in life? And meditation is great because meditation is a time-saving practice. If you do lots of meditation, that you don't have to spend so much time at the doctor's. You're healthy. You don't have to spend so much time at the divorce lawyer. Because you're easy to get on with. You don't have to spend much time at the psychologist and the therapist because you know how to deal with these problems in life. It's a really good investment. And also it makes you far more efficient at whatever you do in your life, even sleeping at night. When you know how to meditate, you know how to go to sleep. Even on this retreat, and the retreats which I give over any place in the world, I know that these teachings show you how to sleep. Because during the meditation sessions, I open my eyes, yeah, it's worked again. Some of you are fast asleep. So you have many benefits of this. So, once There was a professor from England. No, let's take things around. There's a professor from Sri Lanka who was coming to UK to give a series of lectures, and a visiting professor. And in those days, to get from Sri Lanka to UK, you didn't have aircraft. You had boats, passenger liners. So there he was, the first night at sea, and the professor, this is a professor in the old state of the story, one of my favourites. So the professor, after dinner, went up on deck to take the air and have a stroll, and he saw an old sailor just leaning on the railings looking into the ocean. And the professor decided to have a conversation with this old sailor. "Old man," said the professor, "how long have you been a sailor?" He said, "I don't really remember. I became a sailor when I was maybe 14 or 15. I spent all my life sailing these oceans." "Amazing," said the professor. "Now, one of my hobbies is marine science. You must have been watching these oceans for such a long time. You've probably seen some amazing creatures. Let's compare notes about marine science and all the flora and fauna which live in the oceans on which you sail." The professor looked at the old sailor looked at the professor. "Marine what?" "Marine science. Don't know anything about it. All I know is the ocean's wet and salty." "Is that all you know?" said the professor. "In all these years at sea, you've never bothered to learn about the oceans on which you sail?" "Nope." "You stupid old man. What a waste of a life," said the professor, and he walked away. Because whatever you're doing in life, surely you should not investigate and learn about the places in which you live. But anyway, the next night at sea, the dinner was really good. So the professor was in a good mood. When he went up for a stretch of his legs on deck, he saw the old sailor again. This time the old sailor was looking at the stars. And that was another hobby of the professor, astronomy. So the professor went up to the old man and said, "Let's forget about last night. The stars, these are what you use to guide your ship so you know which way you're going. You must be an expert on astronomy." "Astro what?" said the old man. "I don't know anything about it. I don't know what you're talking about. They're just stars to me." "What? In all these years at sea, you've never bothered and cared to get out a book about astronomy and the stars which guide your ship?" "Nope." "You stupid old man. You stupid old man. What a waste of a life. What a waste of a life." Went away. The third night at sea, this time the cook just surpassed himself. He made us a beautiful meal. The professor was so happy that when he went on deck, he was in a really great mood and decided to give the old sailor another chance. Because this evening, there was a fragrant breeze wafting over the ocean. And the professor went next to the old sailor and said, "I'm sorry about those last two nights. I'm going to UK to give a series of lectures on meteorology. Because I realize now that maybe you're not really so necessary to learn about marine science underneath the boat or the stars above. But the winds and the storms, they could sink your ship. They could dry the sails of your ship. That is really important. Let's compare notes about meteorology." "Meteor what?" said the old man. "What are you talking about? The weather." "Well, yeah, I know the weather's windy, rainy, that's all I know." "What?" said the professor. "In all your years at sea, you've never bothered to learn anything about the world around you? You know, nothing about marine science, nothing about astronomy, and more importantly, nothing about meteorology, about the weather?" "Nope." "You stupid old man, you stupid old man, you stupid old man." You notice every time it increases, one time it's just different. That's where I know where I am in the story. What a waste of a life. What a waste of a life. I'm never going to talk to such an idiot again. And the professor walked away. The fourth night at sea. Don't worry, it's finishing soon. The fourth night at sea. The professor never had any dinner because it was a very rough night at sea. And the professor suffered from seasickness, so he decided to stay in his cabin. A bit hungry, but better than being sick. And as the night wore on, as the clock ticked closer and closer to midnight, the boat rocked and rolled more and more and more. It was a very rough storm they were sailing into. And he was very scared as the boat, no way he could sleep, as the boat rocked more and more, and suddenly, bang! It is important that any teachers put some oomph into their presentation. Heard a very loud bang, and everything went quiet. The next thing he heard, people were running outside his cabin door. He's really afraid. So he opened his cabin door. And who was running outside? The old sailor. And the old sailor stopped, turned to the professor, and said to the professor, "Professor, in all your years of study, have you ever learned swimming?" Actually, he said, "No, I can't swim." "You stupid professor, what a waste of a life. The ship is sinking." The moral of that story is, if you are a sailor, yeah, it's nice to know astronomy, marine science, meteorology, but the most important thing to know as a sailor is how to swim. And the most important thing to know in this life as a human being, how to keep your head above water, how not to sink, nor the trials and tribulations and storms of life. So there will be many difficulties for each one of us as we go through our lives. And to be able to learn how to meditate, to be peaceful, to put things down, take a rest, get perspective. So often, I tell people, what is the problems of life? It's the story of how big is my hand? How big is my hand? Depends where I hold it. If I put my hand here, it's so huge, I can't see any of you. All I can see in the whole universe is my hand. It's totally obsessed with my hand. It's not my hand's problem, it's because I've lost my perspective. If I put my hand where it belongs, at the end of my arm, the hand isn't smaller in size, it's the same size. But now I can see each one of you, and see the beautiful trees outside. I can see everything, once I put my problem in perspective. Our difficulty is, once the problem is right in front of us, we just can't push it away. We haven't learned those meditative tricks to let go, leave things alone. And so the problem comes in perspective. So these are the ways where, when you learn meditation, it becomes such an important tool of life that we will give it priority. When a Swedish professor came to see Ajahn Chah, and this was 40 years ago at least, and asked him about meditation, because even Sweden had heard that meditation was very powerful. And he was sent by the government of Sweden on an official mission to do research on meditation. He went to all the most well-known meditation teachers in South and Southeast Asia, and because, you know, what research is like, you have to standardize the questions so you can compare the answers. So he had four questions he was asking every guru, teacher of meditation, spiritual leader he could find in South and Southeast Asia. And they came to the Ajahn Chah. And the four questions he asked Ajahn Chah were these. What is meditation? Why do you meditate? How do you meditate? And what do you get out of meditation? And I was there at Ajahn Chah's hut when this man came to ask those questions. And Ajahn Chah listened, because this was a diplomat. He was sent by the government of Sweden. He had a diplomatic envoy. So he had to take him seriously. So Ajahn Chah said, please, I need a piece of paper and a pencil. And that's the only time I've ever seen Ajahn Chah answer questions by writing on a piece of paper. We all knew Ajahn Chah was up to something again. We couldn't wait until whatever he did. It was really interesting the way that he answered his questions. And then what those questions again, I translated into Thai, and then he scratched his head and wrote something down. He never does that. Again, we knew he was playing around. And then he wrote his questions and gave it to the translator to actually translate into English so the Swedish professor could write them down and take them back to his government. My venerable masters, reply and answer to your first question. What is meditation? His answer is, what is eating? The second question, why do you meditate? His answer is, why do you eat? Third question, third answer. How do you meditate? The venerable liberated master's answer is, you know, I forget why, I wasn't a why, or what. How do you eat? And the fourth question, fourth answer, what do you get out of meditation? What do you get out of eating? And the Swedish professor was not amused at all. He said, I can't take those back to my government. And Ajahn Chah, that's all I'm giving you. And so the Swedish professor went away, really disappointed, but he had to take those answers, that's what he was given. But what brilliant answers they were. What's eating? You've been doing that for all your life, and you know what to do? Of course you do. What is meditating? It's a natural thing to do. It's, as Ajahn Chah used to say, food for the heart. The stuff which you eat, put in your mouth, is food for the body. Second question. What is meditation? Why do you meditate? Why do you eat? For health. How do you meditate? How do you eat? It's something quite natural, learning how to be still. And what do you get out of meditation? What do you get out of eating? Health. Healthy body, healthy mind. Brilliant little teachings, but very, very simple. When you know how to meditate, then you know how to eat. When you've got a very big heart, of course you'll have a big body as well. I've often told people that this is not fat. Been around for 45 years now. Every year I get kinder. My heart grows in compassion. 45 years of growing a big heart. A long time ago, my heart was so big. It was pressing against my ribcage. And it still had a lot of place to grow. So there's only one place it could go. It went down and out. This is not fat, it's a big heart. That's my excuse, and I'm sticking to it. So if you give it priority, meditation, it's like food. You always have time to eat. You always have time to meditate. And frankly, if you're a monastic, or if you've been meditating a lot, if you have a day or two without meditating, it's like you're fasting. You get very weak. You don't feel good. And your friends and relations know that. At least out of compassion for the people who have to put up with you. please meditate. So how many times? Oh, yeah. The one I remember the first time this happened, this woman came to my meditation class one Tuesday evening, and after the class was finished, she came up and said, "Ajahn, I have to tell you this. I didn't want to come this evening. I've been at work, and I was tired. I just wanted to put my feet up and watch anything on the TV. But my little 5 or 6 year old said, 'Mummy, are you going to meditation tonight?' 'No, darling, I'm tired.' 'Mummy, you should go to meditation tonight.' 'I don't want to.' 'Mummy, go meditation now.' 'Why, darling?' 'Because you're a much nicer mummy after you've come home for meditation.'" The wisdom of children is unarguable. So she came for the sake of her kids, for the sake of your husband, your wife, for the sake of all the people that you work with in your business. Please meditate out of compassion for all of them. So that's a nice little segue into how I usually finish off these retreats, with a guided meta meditation. Because sometimes when we think, oh, just doing jhanas, that's okay for me, but how does it help the world? Enormously. I can't resist this story. I can't resist any stories, actually, as you found out. But a couple of years ago, there is a very well-known TV program in Australia. It's based on some of the stuff in the UK, a Q&A program, question answers, where they invite luminaries, experts from around the world, and ask them topical questions on issues of the time. And this one was a panel on terrorism. And one of the presenters, apparently, was the editor of Spectator magazine in UK, which apparently is quite a right-wing magazine, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, a right-wing magazine. And anyway, they were asking for, how can we deal with terrorism, especially with the war in Iraq at the time? And this is why I was told about this, because the editor of the Spectator said they just published an article in their magazine about an experiment which was done in Brighton University, where they got many students to meditate for the day, and they found out that violence and aggression in the university and the surrounds diminished very much, significantly. And it was proving that when you meditate, somehow you calm the surroundings down as well. So the editor of the Spectator said, my solution to easing the conflict in Iraq and Syria is to parachute Buddhist monks and nuns into the conflict zone, and then their meditation will calm everybody down. And at the time, being a very cheeky monk, I thought of many monks and nuns I would volunteer to be parachuted into Iraq. I'm a very uncompassionate monk. Have you got any suggestions? But of course you'd never ever do such things, but it's true that all the kindness and the gentleness and the peace which you generate does affect others. And you've seen already how it affects the nuns who run this place and the other people. They actually feel what you're doing. And all the animals, they get to know what's happening. So actually you spread a lot of your kindness, goodness and peace, whether you think you're doing it or not, is automatic. That's one of the reasons why it's great to meditate. And so now we're going to do this loving kindness meditation to make this palpable. So sitting down comfortably wherever you can. And to bring all your awareness into this moment. I know this is close to the end of this retreat, but who knows? You may decide to extend it for a week. The future is uncertain. One of those you flying away. Maybe the Heathrow Airport has been closed down by climate extinction protesters. You can't go anywhere. Who knows the future? So we can always live in the present moment as much as we can. So, all the awareness in the present moment, and especially with your body. If you can't be kind to your body, how can you be kind to others? So you ask your legs, legs, how are you? My poor legs have been sitting here since 2 o'clock. Ah, please, just another half hour, legs. No, kindness works. Feel my butt, well, that does need adjusting. And ask my back, how are you doing? Do you want a stretch? My one does. I really care for my back. I look upon it as an essential part of my being. Something which I care about, look after, and then it looks after me without too much aches or pains. When I look after my hands and my arms, how are you? One of my hands is holding the microphone, so can I get used to this now? So you're happy there, hand? The other hand is in my lap. And I do fit it a lot in the beginning, so that I don't need to fit it in the middle in the end. And my neck, make sure that that's comfortable. My head, well balanced. My face, relaxed as much as I can make it. Then I aware of my whole body, how everything joined together now. Sitting here for another half hour to do some kindness meditation. But before I even begin, I feel the body. It's the unit, all parts working together. In harmony, relaxed. When I look for relaxation, I find it. When I look for ease, I can see it. And the relaxation, the ease, has a distinctive delight, pleasure to it. And that pleasure, that delight, is what takes me deeper into relaxing. It's how I can relax to the max. And relaxation heals a lot of irritations and inflammations. Human body often just overreacts. I learn how to calm the body. So it relaxes so much that even around injuries or pains, the body is soft and at ease, allows the body to heal itself. When I'm ready, I let the body go. I look at my peaceometer first. How peaceful am I? I know if I send my mind to the future, it gets tense again. If I drag things from the past, again it gets tired. If I can maintain my awareness in this moment, my peaceometer shows a calmer and calmer reading, going closer and closer to one. So I'm aware my mindfulness is on the peaceometer. Once the mind is peaceful enough, it's the time I start my metta meditation, loving kindness. In this way of developing loving kindness, I compare metta, compassion, loving kindness, to be like lighting a fire. I have to start with something which easily takes the flame, like paper or fire lighter. And then I add little twigs, we call them kindling. And once the kindling is alight, then I can put on bigger sticks and bigger pieces of wood. And so once the fire is burning and has heat in it, then I can put on the big logs. Even the big sappy logs. And the fire is hot enough for those big logs to be dried out and start burning, to be warmed by loving kindness. So my primary object of loving kindness, I choose to be an imaginary object, which is easier to develop loving kindness towards. And I've often chosen a little kitten, abandoned, lost, and hurting. You may choose a puppy or a rabbit or a baby, or as one very innovative woman in Sydney did, a flower pot, a flower in a pot on a balcony. Something which you can nurture, something which needs you. I start with a little kid. You can imagine a little dog if you wish. And I imagine walking along the street. And I hear this sound, this moan, which is full of sadness, but also fear. It sort of calls me, I can't ignore it. Some little being is hurting so much. When I follow the sound, I see in a dark little corner, in a hole, in a recess, two eyes looking at me. It's the eyes of a little kitten, a baby cat who has been abandoned by the mother or somehow separated. It has no one to protect her, to feed her, or to give her warmth. Alone, vulnerable, fragile little being. It's hiding because it's been hurt so many times. Every time it's trusted anybody, it's been bitten and scratched. And that poor little being has had so much suffering in the few days it's been in this world. No, only pain. Pain and trust being battered. But somehow it knows it cannot exist without the help of another. And its cries, its moans are to me, "Can you help?" I look at each of her eyes, peering at me. I can't resist. Dear little kid, maybe a big tubby muck, very busy, but I can find the time to care for you, to look after you. And as I make eye contact with this hurting little being still hiding in the corner, I start to spread my loving kindness. First with words, but the words are only there to initiate the feelings, the emotion of kindness. Dear little being, not all huge animals like
Homo sapiens.
We're not all hurtful. Many of us are kind. Please let me look after you and care for you. Dear little kid, I care. You can see in the kid's eyes there's the first glimmer of hope and even trust. As I pour my kindness through my eyes into this little being, and see that his eyes come out from the corner, and I can see the head, the ears and the whiskers, the little pink nose of his kin. She's approaching me. Only her head. Dear little kid, don't be afraid. I will never harm you. Please give me the privilege
of looking after you, of feeding you, of getting you some milk and some fish and whatever you need. I want to see you, be a friend to you, to see you grow and play and rip any curtains which you cry, and to become a real kitten and a kind cat. Please, let me look after you. As I spread these feelings of loving kindness, I imagine them as a golden light from my heart, going through my chest and bathing this little being. And it comes out a little further from the darkness. And I feel now is the time I can extend my hand. As I extend my hand towards this little kitten, slowly, with so much kindness, because I know if that cat has any doubts, any fear, he will go back in that hole and probably never come out and die there, starving, rejected, cold. I extend my arm. It lets me touch her. I can feel her fur. Most cats, even kittens, their fur is smooth and silky and clean. This cat's fur is matted, dirty. I can understand the solid lumps of blood, dried. That poor cat has been scratched and bitten so many times. And as I hold that cat in my hand, it's a tiny being. All I can feel is the bones protruding through the skin. That cat must be so hungry. But with every bit of mindfulness and kindness and gentleness I can generate, I pick that kitten up, bring her out of the hole, always keeping eye contact to maintain trust, always spreading this beautiful loving kindness. Now I can see the tail, the little paws, the tip of the ears and the whiskers. I send that loving kindness to all parts of this little kitten, drenching her, soaking her, bathing her in my unconditional love and care. You must have been hurting so much. Thank you. Thank you so much for giving me the privilege to care for you. As I lift up that little kitten, I bring it close to my own chest, holding this little mass of fur and bones close to me, warming it, letting her realize that not every being in this world is dangerous and will hurt you. There's some beings who will protect and care and feed and nurture you. As I hold it close to my chest, I allow these feelings of loving kindness and metta coming out from my heart. Golden light, getting stronger and stronger, more intense, as it goes right into this little kid's body, healing the wounds and the pain. Removing all the fear, just soothing any terror, and holding that little kitten, bathing her my loving kindness. Little kitten, you have a friend, a big fellow who will protect you, will find food for you, who will care for you, never let you down. as I think these thoughts with the meaning which they are signposts to. I notice my little kin gets soft. The tightness in his body relaxes. I see the little kin closing her eyes. She's trusting me. As she closes her eyes, I start to hear a little purr. Maybe the first time that little kin has felt safe enough and happy enough to purr. Little kitten, you have a friend. And as I give these feelings, this commentary of loving kindness towards this little kitten, I too start to feel a tingling in my chest. Very pleasant feeling. As you give loving kindness to another being, even an imaginary one, you get some happiness, some joy, some power. Giving loving kindness is a blessing. And so now, it's as if I put my imaginary little kitten aside, safe and warm, fast asleep. And I imagine somebody else in my life. Maybe the closest person to you in this life. Your best friend, your brother, your sister, your lover, a child, a parent. Someone who is real. And you imagine them standing right in front of you now, as if they were really here. And you start to notice the similarities between that little, vulnerable, sensitive, hurting little kitten and this big person who's your best friend, closest companion in this life. They too need your kindness, need your love, need your friendship. They too are subject to all these disappointments, pains, and hard words, sicknesses and cancers. They too are subject to crying. Pain. That's your friend, the closest person to you in this life. Look at them, my dear friend, my dear companion. I may not say it, but I care for you. You're my friend. We travel together in this life on so many journeys. I know that you may not show it, you may be stoic and hard and understand inside you are too soft and vulnerable like that little kitten. May you be well and happy, strong. May you know that you have a friend. A friend close by you can count on. My dear closest companion, I care for you. As these rays of loving kindness, this golden light, starts to come out of your chest into this, your friend, going right inside them, up to their head, to their nose and ears, down their arms to their fingertips, down their body, their legs, to every toe. The mind has power. Now you use that power to heal, to comfort, to give confidence, to take away any fear or anxiety in your best friend. You can even imagine invisible arms coming out from your side, going out round the back of your best friend, pulling them towards you. Hugging, embracing,
Okay. And then without opening your eyes, you imagine all the people in this room right now. The monk, the nuns, all the men and women in this room. You'd be surprised at how much we share in common. We get in pain, disappointed, misunderstood. Sometimes feeling alone. Sometimes just needing to know there's someone out there who cares for us. So now from your heart, you send out this golden light of loving kindness to all beings in this room. May you all be at peace, without fear, confident, at peace, healthy and open. May you receive the loving kindness which we each give you. And as this rays of light coming from each person in this room go into you and out to everybody in this room, this whole web of kindness getting stronger, with what's between us glowing with care, kindness and acceptance. I will not judge you. You don't have to do anything to live up to anything, to give me anything, to know of my commitment and love to you. I care. An unconditional, unbounded, loving kindness and to everybody in this room. May we all know peace, freedom, nirvana. We can feel the loving kindness. First of all, imaginary, and then it gets palpable, like we can touch it. As we build it up between us, healing, protecting, feeding, until when it gets so strong, the walls of this room cannot contain it anymore. It breaks through until it goes to all the people in this compound, all the nuns and the cooks and the people working here. May all beings in this compound be happy and well, be free of fear, be at ease and at peace, to know the joy of unconditional love. As this goes even further, further out to the park, to all those animals in the park, the deer and the birds, those underground, those up in the sky, to all the people in the villages around here. As this golden light spreads further and further, healing, giving, soothing. You can imagine this golden light of loving kindness over the whole city of London and the suburbs of Greater London, Outer London, where many of your friends and family live. May you all be at peace, knowing you don't have to live up to any ideal to have my kindness and love. The door of our hearts are totally open, no matter who you are, no matter what you've done. Unconditional loving kindness. In this great city of London, there are people who are so scared, having argued with people they love, just wanting this little bit of forgiveness. There are people in the hospitals fighting for their lives, and people hoping against hope, the people they live with and love are going to pull through. Animals in pain, birds who are hungry. May all beings in this city
find peace in this moment, freedom from fear, joy, contentment. This is loving kindness goes even further, spreading over the whole country, to Europe where many of you come from, even further to Ireland, to Africa and Asia, Australia, New Zealand, the United States, South America. As this loving kindness spreads over the whole world, a golden light like a blanket enveloping this orb on which we live. Not only healing any separations between human beings, soothing, healing, energizing, even the planet Earth on which we walk, run and live. May even the Earth recover, be healthy again, be green and pure. May all beings and all life on this earth receive my loving kindness. Receive our energy, our care, our respect. This is golden light of loving kindness goes over the whole planet Earth. And then there's one person you've left out. That's you. The one who bears your name. Imagine then, like you are looking in a full-length mirror at yourself. This being, who you wake up with in the morning, is the last person you see before you go to bed at night. Who's always with you no matter where you go in this world, the person who bears your name. Sometimes we're very hard on ourselves. We set ourselves such high standards which we'll never ask any other people to live up to. We can be kind to others, but now is the time to give this unconditional loving kindness towards yourself. So imagine this golden light going into your body, right up to your head, soothing the face and your overworked brain, going down through the organs of your torso, healing the body, the heart and the lungs, always working. Thank you so much. Your stomach digesting, the whole body working so hard. I care for you, body. Whatever you've done in the past or happened to you, the kindness you find you can let go, the hot of the fire, the loving kindness, the more impossible things can be warmed, burnt and let go of. The pain of the past, people have hurt you, things you've done. This loving kindness gets very strong. You cannot resist forgiveness. May I be at peace. May I be free of worry, anxiety, suffering. Could you give loving kindness to this being who bears your name? Now I'm going to be quiet for a minute or two to let you pause. How do you feel? Like all things, they must come to an end. So imagine that golden light spread over the whole planet Earth. Imagine drawing it in, retracting the light, but leaving the warmth. Drawing it in from all the edges of this planet into UK, into London, into Roehampton, into this Kairos compound, into this meditation hall, into your body, until you imagine this loving kindness now all collected into a golden ball of intense metta light, like a little sun inside of you. Imagine your heart like an open lotus, pure white in colour, with the loving kindness hovering just above it. And the petals of the white lotus closing very gently around the seed of loving kindness. To keep it in your heart to be used another time, another place. Please keep your eyes closed as I give the final blessing to this retreat.
Be quiet for a while. Well, how can you start to say something? Because I get a bit pissed out with my own teaching. I don't know if that's what that sounds like. Anyway, we're supposed to be talking about Anicca, which really project. So, basically, then we'll chandle with everybody just how I can serve. There you go.
Say?
Compassionate. You've got lots of compassion there. Yeah. Okay, I'll just start. You have to do something. Okay. So, on October the 22nd, 10 years ago,
Not that long ago. What day is today? October the 30th?
Yeah.
10 years and 8 months ago, I ordained some very deserving nuns as bhikkhunis in Australia. Why? Why not? They were great candidates. Very sincere, long-serving nuns. And they wasn't my idea. It was just they asked. They initiated it. Why not? So I did that ordination. I know afterwards, you may have heard this so many times, but afterwards when I came to UK, I think it was at the London Buddhist Society, and a woman came up to me. She said after that ordination, she said, this is what she said, that things are very dark for Theravada women in England now. The way she said it, that one of those words was went right inside. Just 5 years before, in Australia, I gave a talk, and then this elderly man, he said he was a leader of the gay community in Perth. He said religion has been very cruel to gays, lesbians, transgenders. And he said it was such pain, you could feel it. And when people convey such pain, you just can't just leave it alone and say, well, you sort it out. You have to do something. So therefore the LGBTQIA, but when I'm full energy, I can remember it all. But sometimes when you're tired, you'd be speaking all most of the day. Sometimes you forget a few words, so it's not sort of, please, I'm trying my best. But they said that we need help. So I gave them as much help as possible. And I had one of my greatest rewards when I got an invitation in the post to the Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras breakfast in Perth. And I thought, hey, marvellous. You know, that they'd appreciated something. At least something, not very much, but at least some leader of one of the religions had actually spoken out for inclusion. And obviously kept on whatever I can do to help out. And of course, with the ordination of bhikkhunis, it's something which can be done, should have been done a long time ago. So no one else does it. It's not somebody else's problem. Stupid old Ajahn Brown puts his head on the chopping block. I do it. Not stupid. But very willing to do that. So now we have bhikkhunis, but there's no bhikkhuni monastery in UK. And I feel a bit responsible. I know I should feel responsible. I've done enough already. But nevertheless, I was born in this land. I've studied here. I went to school here. This is my area around here. And so I thought, nah, I can't just forget about this. I've got to do whatever I possibly can to get not just ordination of bhikkhunis. It's not just giving ordination. It's looking after them afterwards, training them. When you have a kid, it's not just having a kid, having a child, you've got to look after them, care for them, nurture them, bring them up, take them to school, have them a place where they can go to when they grow up. It's all of that too. So you know, sometimes people ask me, do you miss, you know, having a relationship and having a family? What do you mean? I've got many kids. All my monks over in Perth. Sometimes they're like my little children. Sometimes I don't know what they're up to, but I trust them. You nurture them, teach them, and then eventually give them monasteries so they can go out and just serve themselves. You know, every now and again, when you have a kid, you have a really good one. They feel really so proud. That's my boy. Yeah. You feel so proud of your children. Oh, that's my daughter. You feel so proud of your children. They can drive you crazy sometimes, but sometimes with children, sometimes they do wonderful things. And so that is part of my duties and jobs. To actually to get a thriving monastery for bhikkhunis here in the UK.
We've done that over in Perth. We have Dharmasala Nansa Monastery. Some of you have seen it, and it's brilliant. You know, just, we have a whole community. How many is it? Is it 13? 14 bhikkhunis?
Or 12 bhikkhunis.
12 bhikkhunis, that's right, and 2 sannyasis.
And 2 anagatas.
Thank you. That's 12 bhikkhunis. And it's only a very small place. 583 acres. It's a brilliant place. And the whole, how this all works, is it's just inspiration. It works on inspiration, it grows on inspiration. And so, the story of Dharmasala. I shouldn't have given me the microphone.
No, I shouldn't, because I'm going to go out for now. Maybe we should do the story of Anakampa.
Around Anakampa, okay. That is your story.
Story of Dharmasala in brief.
Okay, in brief, okay.
So, first of all, first thing you do, let people know you want to do this. You all agree? They said yes. Even all the Asian communities, the Thai communities, everybody had a meeting. Yeah, we want it to happen. So let's get a fund. We got a fund, maybe 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 in the bank. That's not enough to get very much. Until the fellow came along. He's Australian. He came along and said, my wife has just given birth to my first child. I want to do something to celebrate the birth of my first child, who's a daughter. He said, I'm a Buddhist. And he said, I don't know if my daughter would ever want to become a Buddhist nun, but I want her to have the choice in case she wants to. So here's a check towards your project. $250,000 in one check. Ooh, that was amazing. And then, of course, that we had some money to actually get something appropriate, not a tiny little house. So we were looking for land, looking for something. We went down this road looking for some other land, and then we passed the for sale sign. 583 acres of perfect solitude. I said, let's have a look. I said, no, we can't afford that, said the driver. Who knows what we can afford? Let's have a look. It doesn't cost anything to have a look. When you have a look, perfect place. But totally out of our price range. But it was being sold on auction. So who knows what the price was. So together with one of the other monks, we went there half an hour earlier, before the auction. And we did some of these really powerful chants. We did. We get all the heavenly beings, everyone on our side. Was that corruption? I don't know, but anyway, it worked. We had 600,000 in the kitty. And we hoped, we bid, you know, in auctions, it was 25,000 sort of chants, we bid 600,000. And then I started doing every psychic power I could to keep people quiet. It didn't work. So we put out hands, 625. We'd lost the property. See, we couldn't afford 625 or any other amount until the person we had bidding for us totally disrespected my instructions and the treasurer's instructions and bid 650. And I was standing next to the treasurer. He was going ballistic. We can't do this. No, he's got no authority to bid 650. We can't afford it. I said, shut up. And it passed at 650. We got it for 650. And of course you raise the difference somewhere or other. That's how Buddhism works. We just have this incredible, stupid inspiration which always works out. People think it's stupid, but it's actually how this world works. And it means the temple comes in a beautiful way. And that's how that one worked. And it's thrived. It's got beautiful... How many people have been to Dharmasala Monastery? What do you reckon of it? Would you like to have one of those in England?
Yes, sure.
Excellent, yes. There we go.
Where's the bush?
We've got a bush. I was born in the bush. Shepherd's bush.
Okay, enough of that.